podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Another season ender. Hello and welcome to episode 43 of this season's Real Football Cast. As always, I'm your host Dan Tracy, and in the next 60 minutes, we'll be dissecting all the hot topics in football. As per usual, we'll be discussing what's been going on in the Premier League over the past few days, while in addition to that, there are also some off-pitch activities that have caught our eye and they'll be getting our attention in the next hour. It's been another incredible week of football, and this week it's two up top. That means leading the line and wearing the captain's armband is Carl. So Carl, how have you been since we last spoke?
Yeah, really good. Thanks, Dan. You know, as a Spurs fan, it was the perfect end to the season. You know, Newcastle did their bit for us, and that led us into this weekend just to need to get a result at Norwich, and we did. So a very happy boy with Champions League back, and looking forward to talking all things an exciting end to the Premier League season, mate.
Absolutely. I'll echo those sentiments. Also, last but certainly not least, is Matthew. Matthew, how was the final day experience on the other side of the pond?
I'll tell you what, it was brilliant. It was brilliant to watch, having it, you know, from a different perspective, not having the likes of, you know, Jeff Selling, all that lot taking care of it. We had the NBC feed, and it was pretty good, I must say. You know, a lot of Americans get a lot of stick for, you know, the soccer coverage and everything like that. But I give credit to NBC and their people. They did an excellent job of it.
Glad to hear. I'm sure they will take your words on board as well. So, right, we've got so much to chat about in the next 60 minutes or so. I best do the social media bits first, otherwise we'll be talking into the abyss once more. First, if you want to get in touch with me, you can. That's on Twitter, at DanTracy1983. Also, the podcast has its own account, which is at Real Football Pod. And if you want to become a shareholder, all you need to do is follow and join our very elite members club, which now has over 1,600 members. So thanks to you all. Talking of clubs, I'm delighted to announce we're now part of the UK's first ever sports podcast network, that being Sports Social. So check out the URL and all the links posted throughout the week on the Real Football Pod account. You can find me via iTunes by searching for Real Football Cast. If you use that platform, don't forget to subscribe. And if you like us, leave a review so we move up the league table. Also, I need to mention my content partner, that being betting.com. And the easiest way to find all the links is by going to linktree.com/realfootballcast. Put a dot between the R and the E. You get 10 podcast platforms to choose from. It's never been easier to listen to this show. Right, it's time to go live. And where should we go first? We can only go to the Etihad. And Cole, although it wasn't quite Aguero 2012 levels, this season's finale ranks rather high when it comes to drama.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it, Dan? And, you know, the Etihad is the place to be for last day drama, isn't it? Clearly, you know, it all seems to go on there. And, you know, couldn't quite believe what we were seeing when, you know, Villa went 2-0, you know, let alone 1-0. When it went to 2-0, you just thought, what is going on? You know, City just not getting the job done. You kind of thought, have they kind of bottled this and that? But then, obviously, you know, when you've got that sort of quality that they've got on the pitch, I guess it can, you know, what happened can kind of happen. And, you know, that is a team that can go out and blitz someone in the blink of an eye. But what a turnaround, because at one point it was very much looking like the title could be heading to Anfield if the results went the right way. And City, you know, that would have been probably one of the biggest blow-ups you've ever seen. But credit to City, you know, when it's at the Etihad, they like to give us some drama and they like to kind of put themselves matches that we'll be watching in 10 years' time and going, well, could you believe this? You know, they were two down, the title looked gone, but then they went and turned it round. It just had it all, didn't it? You know, the last day had it all, and that just kind of, you know, typified what was going on the last day. Brilliant scenes. And, you know, credit to them for getting, you know, having a character to kind of come back and turn it round. And thankfully they got the job done for themselves, and we can't knock it and say they aren't deserved winners, because over the course of a season, the numbers that these teams are racking up, you know, in the points total, the goals totals, it's something special, and you have to give credit to them and Pep for the way that they've done it. And obviously, you know, we know they've already gone and strengthened already for next season, so we just have to see if there's anyone out there that can kind of match those two and get closer to them.
Yeah, this is it. City, 4 title wins in 5, and now they've got Haaland. So I guess opposition teams are thinking, oh dear, like, where do we go from here? But Matthew, in terms of, I guess, the final day that we just had and the final day in 2012, once again, City suffered massive stage fright. Now, for a team which was undoubtedly a well-oiled machine from week 1 to week 37, where did it all go wrong at the start of week 38?
I don't know. I think maybe they just expected to be able to roll over Aston Villa, and then they're just like, you know, what's the old phrase? Everyone has a game plan until they get punched in the mouth. Aston Villa gave them a bloody good punch in the mouth, I think it needs to be said. Just caught them by surprise. I think they just assumed they would be able to go in and, you know, not walk over Aston Villa, because Aston Villa have been a good side, but at least, you know, get the first goal to settle the nerves. And then when the first goal goes against them, and especially given the way Aston Villa were defending, yeah, it's just a case of, what's going on here? So I think it's really just, that. I think just, you may stay stage fright, which would be somewhat apt because of the way they've, you know, handled certain things at points this season. You know, talking about the, you know, the Champions League semi-final and all that, they've shown that, I'm not going to say they've shown that they can bottle it on the big occasion, but because they've won plenty of trophies before, but I just think maybe this season there was just something just slightly off with them. And then, yeah, and then when they go 2-0 down, you just think, I think they needed that second goal just to really, you know, push them. Because we know what a great attacking team Manchester City are. And I think they just need that second goal to say, right, let's just go hell for leather and just, you know, and just go for it at this point. Because, you know, when they were 2-0, when they were 2-0 down, I think Liverpool was still drawing.
Yeah.
So, you know, what? Yes. So when they were 1-0 down, rather, one goal would have still given them the title to say they've been final game. But that needing to go and get three at that point, I think just, you know, kicked them into that, right, we've got nothing more to lose at this point, so just go for it. And then, you know, results speak for themselves.
Well, this is it, Carl, because it was all right in the end, obviously, for City. But, you know, a lesser team would have wilted at 2-0 down. This team, I guess it kind of shows the real quality needed to not only spoil Liverpool, but to be a championship-winning team. And to have that five-minute burst to get three goals, I guess that kind of wins the title on its own, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's the thing, isn't it? You know, that side have got those attacking players that can do that to any team, you know, at any moment, any team. You know, Liverpool were cruising in that FA Cup semi-final at one point, weren't they? And then all of a sudden City come to life, and the next thing you know, Liverpool are kind of hanging on at the end. So when you've got that attacking capability on the pitch, you've always got goals in you. Man City have always been a little bit susceptible at the back, haven't they? You know, they are a team that you can get at, and they've always got mistakes in them that kind of make you feel like you've got a chance. But at the other end, unless you're fully concentrated for a full 90 minutes and you've got the energy to keep going for 90 minutes, the minute you wilt or the minute you switch off, players of those quality will punish you. And that's what kind of happened. You know, I think Villa just kind of run out of steam a bit towards the, you know, later part of that second half. And that's when that quality came in and kicks in. And ultimately, those top winning sides, that's what it's all about, isn't it? Having the quality and knowing when they can go for the kill and actually being able to put teams to bed. And City have done that over the course of the season.
Well, Matthew, I guess it should be noted that with all this drama unfolding on Sunday, Man City were never actually off the top of the table. So, yes, there was, I guess, a huge fright, but it didn't quite have the to and fro of 10 years ago, did it?
No, it didn't. You know, the fact that, you know, the Liverpool game went the way it did, because, you know, talk about 10 years ago, Man United took the lead against Sunderland, I think pretty early on. So yeah. I think that set the stage for everything. But with Liverpool, again, you know, they spent most of the time having to get their equaliser first. So, again, that took some of the, I'm not going to say some of the tension, but, you know, it did change the outcome of the game, as you said. You know, Man City never off the top of the table. So there wasn't always that jeopardy on their end, you know, until, you know, as you said, it never was that case. So, yeah, it just changed it a little bit, but that doesn't mean that it was any less exciting in the grand scheme of things.
Of course it doesn't. And, Carl, we shouldn't really forget Aston Villa's role in Sunday. For the first 70 minutes or so, I think it's fair to say that Stevie G got his counter-attack set up absolutely spot on.
Yeah, he did. And, you know, if Ollie Watkins puts his chance away as well, I know, you know, might have been slightly offside. But again, City looked nervy, didn't they? They didn't go into this game thinking, right, this is one where we, you know, we've cruised to the title. They look nervy. And Villa, you know, Villa are a good side. You know, they seem to go in fits and starts, don't they? It's consistency that kind of lets Villa down. You know, when Stevie came in, he suddenly started getting some really good results and everyone was thinking they could move up the table. But then, you know, the consistency issue kicks in and they suddenly drop a few, lose a few, then they pick it back up again. So it's been a good start, in my opinion, under Steven Gerrard. And, you know, if they can get the right players in again in the summer, then you would back Villa to have, again, another reasonable season next season. They've got some good players. Ollie Watkins is a great player. You know, we'll see whether Coutinho makes that a permanent move or not. You know, you've got Mings at the back. They've got a good goalkeeper. So if they can just get some, you know, add a few more additions, then I think Villa will feel confident next season. They might be able to push for, Europa League or Europa Conference place.
Well, Matthew, you did tip Villa for a top 10 finish. They just missed out, but obviously you're not a Villa fan. But if you're looking at performance on Sunday, for the first 70 minutes, admittedly they run out of puff towards the end. But does that give you enough to think, actually, top 10 will be a much more realistic possibility next season?
Yeah, I think top 10 is a realistic expectation, especially if, you know, Gerrard is able to, you know, work some stuff with the transfer market, because he's a big name. He should be able to attract players, you know, Philippe Coutinho being arguably the biggest example of that. You know, and if he gives them, you know, and a proper pre-season and a full season to work with them, I think a top 10 might be a reasonable expectation. I think Europe is probably going to be out of their reach, just when you consider there's seven spots available, and, you know, cups and stuff depending. But if we go through the league, seven spots available. When you think, you know, the top seven as it is, plus you have to factor in the likes of Newcastle into there as well, who will probably be challenging. Leicester, again, you can't rule them out. It'll be very tough, I think, for them to get into the top seven. But I think a top 10 finish would be, you know, a reasonable showing of progress on Steven Gerrard's front.
Yeah, I think you're right in the sense it's going to be, well, it's always cutthroat, isn't it? But when you add the likes of Newcastle into the mix, Leicester are going to want to say about being better than they were this season, even though they finished eighth. It's going to be difficult, but the tools are there. And Stevie G has kind of shown that he's no slouch in the Premier League. I know a lot of people said, well, you know, coming from Scotland, what does he know? But I think his first half season has been a very good half, and who knows what he can do with a full campaign. But Carl, in terms of the distribution of Premier League trophies, as I mentioned just a few minutes ago, it's now 4-5 Man City. For you, has the Premier League got boring, or does the final day suggest that just because the winner is largely the same, it's still a fascinating competition?
Yeah, I don't think the Premier League can ever be called boring, because ultimately what we have in the league is that, yes, I think currently we've got two teams that ultimately I think are just on a different playing field to the rest. You know, we thought Chelsea would probably push them a lot harder this season than they actually did. And, you know, Chelsea will be thankful that they got as many points on the board as early as they did, because the end of the season could have seen them, you know, have another couple of games to go, be looking over their shoulder for that top fourth place in the end. But I think the great thing we've got in the league is that teams can beat Man City and Liverpool. But you've also got a league where, like as we say, you've got seven sides that are always fighting for that, you know, those top four, five, three, four, five, six places. You've got teams in the lower half that you can never write them off pulling off a surprise and winning a game. There's quality throughout the whole league. You know, when you look at all the sides, they've all got quality. And there's never a game where you can say anyone's out of it. You know, even those smaller sides can still sometimes bring a surprise. And I think that's what keeps the Premier League exciting. You know, yes, we will have to, I think, accept that the Premier League for the next couple of seasons is probably going to be a battle between Man City and Liverpool. And you just have to hope that one of those sides, you know, vying just under them can either, you know, pull off some great transfer signings that then make them be able to give them to a harder push than they've had the last couple of seasons. But we've still seen it's been an exciting season. You know, the title was down to the last day. Top four was down to the last day. You know, the Europa League places were down to the last day. Relegation was down to the last day. Not many leagues will go into the final day with that much on the line. So I think it still shows where the strength for the Premier League is and why it is so widely watched and so widely loved all over the world.
Yeah, I think that's a great point you make there. But Matthew, is it not a case of simply swapping the word United for City? Obviously, Sir Alex Ferguson did his dominance, what, a couple of decades ago? Or is it now different with the money attached to the Etihad? Is it a different kind of dominance where we see the likes of PSG or Bayern run riot in their leagues? Is it different or the same?
I know. I think it is different because I think, you know, whilst we don't want to disparage what Sir Alex Ferguson did in Manchester United, but I don't think that Man United were ever as clear favourites for everything as Manchester City are right now. Because even though Man United were going through their dominant spell in the 90s and 2000, it was always a case of, you know, an Aston Villa would win the League Cup, or Chelsea would win the FA Cup, or Liverpool would win the Champions League. There was always these little teams that would always sort of pick off the rest of the trophies. Whereas we're now with Man City and Liverpool as well, to an extent, they are pretty much the clear favourites. It's always Man City, Liverpool, and then the rest of the field. Whereas in Man United's days, you could have easily said, oh, Liverpool can go on and win this. Or, you know, Tottenham won the League Cup in 2001, I want to say, something along those lines. So there was always the chance that someone smaller could come and, you know, pick up one of the rest of the trophies. But with Man City and Liverpool, that's sort of gone. You now expect it to be, you know, assuming they don't meet somewhere along the path, you expect it to be Man City and Liverpool in the vast majority of all finals and challenging for the Premier League. So I think it's different. It's different in a way, you know, whilst, you know, the longevity of the domination is probably going to stay, I just think there's something different about it because they are just so more, you know, the favourites than the Manchester United, you know, and even the Arsenal sides ever were during their heydays.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's like the game has changed in terms of the best and then the rest. So although we're sort of seeing the same teams win in a cycle, you do sort of fear that I hope that it's not 8 out of 10 or, you know, 9 out of 10 that City win and Liverpool win all the cups and so on and so forth. Like, you want the spread, but as Cole rightly says, City and Liverpool are a class apart, and if they carve up every trophy between now and the next 4 or 5 seasons, it wouldn't be that big a surprise. But Cole, of course, Liverpool missed out on the Premier League, so no quadruple. Again, missed out by a single point this season. How defeating is that going to be for Jurgen Klopp and his players?
Yeah, so that is always going to be a hard one to take, isn't it? You know, if you suddenly miss out on a title by 4 or 5 points, then you've accepted it. But missing out on a point is gutting because you look back and it always makes you kind of think, well, what more do we have to do? You know, we've been as good as we've been. You know, Liverpool have only lost 2 games all season. So you kind of sit there and go, well, you almost have to be perfect. You know, you almost have to 38 games and almost win 38 to try and get ahead of the team ahead of you. And the fact that that's a second time now that that's happened to them, it will be a sickening blow. But you've just got to take, you know, you've got to be confident in the fact that you can push that Man City side, given the money it spent, that close, and know that, you know, well, it's just the odd result here and there that's kind of cost us. You know, it's draws that have cost Liverpool this season. You know, they've had 8 compared to City's 6. So, you know, it's those dropping those odd points that's cost them. But you just have to take some comfort in it. You know, when you've had a season where you've been going for the quadruple and, you know, you can't be disappointed in a season like that. You know, you've got to take the confidence that, well, listen, if we just build on it, and Liverpool have, you know, they've done some transfer business early. You know, Diaz in January, they've got, you know, as Matthew will know, they've got the Carvalho young lad as well that they're going to sign. It's all looking good. You know, it depends what they do with Salah. But again, I think they've kind of done business that means if Salah was to leave, they won't be weak again next season. I think they'll still be strong. So they've got to take comfort that they've been able to go that close. If they get the Champions League over the line, then I think they'll still say, you know, what a season. You know, not many sides will have a good a season like that in football. And we go again next season and hopefully, you know, we're the ones that finish a point above them, or we get dominant and we win it by a few points. But you can't be disappointed, I don't think. Sickening, but, you know, have a day, wipe yourself down and get ready to go again.
Well, this is it, Matthew. They're going to have to go again because the Champions League final is on Saturday. They're going to be deflated slightly after what happened on Sunday. There's no doubt about that. But can they pick themselves up for the weekend, or is that deflation going to play into Real Madrid's hands? Is it going to be the treble or just 2 trophies for the Reds?
I don't think there's any sort of need of deflation. Whilst obviously it would have been disappointing, you know, that they didn't win the title. Again, as you said, they were never top of the table, so they never technically threw it away. You know, at least in the final, on the final day, on the last couple of weeks. So it's not going to be. It is a case of, oh, there's only so much, you know, we could do at this point. But I still think they'll be, you know, galvanised and upbeat. They've got Salah back from his, you know, injury scare that he picked up in the FA Cup final. played on, you know, he's got minutes under his belt, so he should be fit for Saturday and all that thing. So I don't think that this, you know, whatever disappointment there would be from this weekend will carry over. I think there is still that level of focus, and you know, to say we can still get a cup treble out of this. So yeah, but even so, even two trophies I think would still be seen as something of a successful season, considering, you know, how far, you know, how far they've gone. You know, the Champions League rather would obviously be the icing on the cake, but if they come out with it with two trophies, and then to take the Champions League, you know, get to the Champions League final and take the Premier League till the final day, I think that's still a pretty very good season, for Liverpool. But I don't think there's going to be anything, you know, that can affect them come Saturday.
Carl, you mentioned draws for Liverpool. That's the next point I was going to raise with you, because when you look at the mini league, there'd be four teams in that, the top four. Played six, drawn six. Now, they'd only need to win one of those to win the Premier League. So as you kind of rightly said, those drop points against the very best teams was the difference maker.
Yeah, that was it, wasn't it? You know, I think they will probably look back on that record against those big sides and say, well, that's probably where we've let ourselves down. I think then they'd probably look back at that game against us, wouldn't they? Anfield, thinking, well, you know, that was a big game, you know, at the moment in time of that title. If they win that, then that's pressure put on City again. But slipping up kind of gave that momentum to City to know they could get it across the line, and allowed them to kind of, even, you know, if Liverpool didn't get a result, even lose that last game of the season and still end up being the title winners. But they will need to know that, yes, they've got to go into the second half of that season and against the top six, get a couple more wins on the ball, because they'll have no problems with the teams below that. You know, the lower sides, they always make sure they get past them, even if they're not playing well. But those draws are the ones that cost them. And ultimately, I think the momentum that, you know, dropping those points against us, you know, it kind of gave momentum in two races, top four in the title, but that might be the one they really look back and think, at home at that point, we should have asserted our dominance in that game.
Well, that was the question I was going to ask you, Matthew, because we spoke about Jurgen Klopp's comments after the Tottenham game a couple of weeks ago. With hindsight being in place now, do you reckon there was maybe a small private admission that those comments came because the title would then slip through their hands?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's fair, because, you know, as Carl said, and I think we've mentioned before, you know, there's only so many mistakes you can make in a Premier League season because of the way that, you know, Man City and Liverpool have separated themselves across the season. That's why, you know, if you're, you know that you need to get 95, 94, you know, Liverpool got 98 points, still didn't get it done. So they know those, you know, those crucial points at the end of the season can come back to hold them. And I think he sort of knew at that point there was no real way for them to catch up. So I think that, as you say, probably was an admission that, yeah, this race is over, we can't catch them.
With that said, Carl, we shouldn't bash Klopp in all of this, because he was rather gracious in his words to Pep Guardiola when City won the title on Sunday. So although this rivalry isn't quite Wenger versus Ferguson, it has been rather entertaining in the last few years, hasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can't knock Klopp, can you? You know, when you consider he came in at Liverpool, and when you consider the side they are now to the side he took over, he has been a great manager. You know, he does lots of things that people don't like. And, you know, the mask can slip every now and then when things don't go their way. But at the same time, that is what top managers do, don't they? You know, I never knew Ferguson come out and take a defeat well, or, you know, a team topping his team well. And ultimately, that's what separates those top managers. You know, you don't want to see a manager accept a defeat well and just take it, you know. He realised after the Spurs game that what he probably said in the heat of the moment wasn't right, and came out and rectified that. But it's what you expected when a microphone is shoved under your face at the very end of a game like that. He is a great manager. As I say, there's certain things I don't like that he does, you know, the standing there staring at teams when they're having their kickabout and all that kind of stuff. You know, I don't see the need for it. But if it works for him, if you're a Liverpool fan, you're not going to moan. You'd love him as your manager. I think he's one of those guys, if he's your manager, you love him. If he's not, you hate him. But he's doing a fantastic job. And the fact that they've gone so far in all those competitions this season just shows what a fantastic manager he is, to be able to kind of, use the squad, rotate it when he needs to, and get those players that are not always key players in doing a job. You know, look at Origi. You know, he must be a great man manager because that guy always comes in and scores a vital goal or two for him. And when you consider that he's, you know, rarely in the side, to keep someone like that motivated to come on and do it, he must be special at something. So we've got to give him credit. I'm sure next season he'll be champion at the bit to make sure that Liverpool win that title next season and he gets one over Pep. So I'm looking forward to it, Dan.
Now, Matthew, a quick word about Wolves. They really went off the boil towards the end of the season. Finished 10th. They kind of slipped under the radar. No one's really talking about that. No win in their last seven. So is that cause for concern, or is it a case of once Europe closes its doors, let's get on the beach, lads?
Yeah, I think that was pretty much the case. But I do think there should still be some level of, you know, respect everything put on Wolves' names. I do think they had a relatively good season. Started off incredibly well. Like, you know, I think they may have had the best defensive record in the league. It was either the best or in like the top three in terms of goals conceded. So they had a decent foundation there. And I think there is still a level of transition going on, and the owners haven't exactly been that kind with the spend. You know, they only really bring in when they've sold big name players. They had the Adama Traore thing. So I think there's just been a whole lot going on at Wolves this season. I think for them to come back and make it into the top 10, especially when you consider they finished, was it 14th, 15th around that point last season, to at least make that step back up again and show there is some progress under Bruno Lage, I think is a good thing. You know, he was never going to be able to step in and do exactly the same as what Nuno did, you know, in his first two seasons in the Premier League. But I think there is still some... There are some very good players on Wolves' side. I think give them another transfer window, I expect them to be, again, not challenging for Europe, because I think there's going to be a lot of bodies in there, but at least within the shout, you know, within that shout come, you know, February, March time, I think. So pretty much the same as this season, which, again, considering where they were 5-6 years ago, I think it's still a pretty good achievement.
It is. I think the only thing they've got to be wary of is Newcastle, because, again, it's another team in the mix. Already Wolves, I guess, are kind of the odd team out, especially when we're looking at, what, March, April this season. We were looking at 8 parties trying to fight for 7 berths. You had Newcastle into the mix. You had a resurgent Leicester. Wolves have stagnated ever so slightly. Obviously, they had the great upsurge under Nuno. That tailed off. And they're kind of finding their feet again, making an upward trajectory up the table. But it's not quite enough. And if you're going to get overtaken, or even if you stand still, you will get left behind. So that's something for the Wolves owners to worry about. But at least they haven't been relegated, because that's where we're going to talk about now, the bottom of the table. It's Leeds who stay up. Carl, going into the final day, would you have envisaged the Yorkshiremen staying up at the expense of Burnley?
No, I have to admit, I think, you know, the last few games leading up to that last game, when you looked at form and the way teams were playing, I was quite confident that, you know, although they hadn't been brilliant, I thought Leeds, Everton and Burnley had probably done enough to see Leeds off. You know, no one put Leeds in that mix at a certain point of the season, but then they suddenly fell in there. And I have to admit, I didn't see them getting a job done, and I thought they'd be the team that go down. So that was a great performance, because Brentford, you know, they've had a massive resurgence towards the second half of the season, because we were worried about them at one point, but they started proving us wrong. And I didn't see Leeds being able to go there and get a result on the last day. So I had them down. So that was a brilliant performance and a brilliant result that has obviously kept them in the league. And now, obviously, they'll have to look and see what they can do in the summer. You know, will they lose, you know, Phillips, who's a massive player for them? If they do, can they then bring in the sort of quality that kind of makes sure they're not in this position next season? You know, Rafinha, there's talk about Barcelona, isn't there? So, you know, if those rumours are true, then I'd see him possibly saying that he'd want to go, because you're not going to turn down Barcelona when that offer comes. So I think this summer is going to be massive for where Leeds can go and make sure they're not in this sort of fight next season.
Now, Matthew, when you look at Burnley and Leeds, is it simply a case of two teams that have rolled the dice late on and only one gamble was going to pay off?
Yeah, I think you got a spot on there. You know, I don't think there are many people who would agree with the sacking of Sean Dyche. You know, even though he got them there, you could argue. I think it is the sort of cliche. I remember, I think it may have been West Brom when they sacked Tony Pulis and everyone said, well, who are you going to bring in to sort of get them out of this mess? It would be Tony Pulis. It's the same thing with Burnley. If you were to appoint someone who would get them out of the out of the position they're in, you would go for Sean Dyche. So the decision to sack him was kind of weird. Bielsa, you can kind of make a better argument for, because that is probably a move for the long term as well. Because I think there was sort of an admission there that style of play was never going to work. Whereas with Burnley, it's not all that expansive and expressive, or, you know, again, no one to put any disrespect on them, but it's not as experimental, as it were, than Leeds. So there are plenty more managers you can just sort of plug in and fill that gap, especially with the players they have. So it's an interesting one, but yeah, it was always going to be a gamble on both ends. But as I said, just only one side managed to, you know, come away with it, especially after the whole Everton thing, because it could very well have been a case that Leeds and Burnley stayed up and Everton went down. But once it was Everton, then, yeah, it was only going to be one team.
Well, this is it, Carl, because when you look at the bottom five teams in the final Premier League table, they all changed their managers throughout the campaign. Watford, obviously, many, many times. But for those relegated outfits, quite simply, their gambles didn't pay off.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at, say, Norwich, I think they could have brought in Houdini, couldn't they? And they were never staying up. You know, I think Norwich, ultimately, once that season started, you always feared for them early on and thought that they could go down. Watford just never seemed to kind of be able to throw any consistency together, did they? You know, they hope that new manager bounce comes, and, you know, the way they're working at the moment, they probably sack a manager every game and see if that can work. But it was pretty clear early on that they were going to struggle. And then, yeah, everyone was like, right, let's roll the dice. I guess the thing with Dyche, would Burnley have stayed up even if Dyche had stayed? I guess, you know, it's easy in hindsight to maybe say, well, if Dyche had been there, would they go down? But at the end, same time, Dyche was the man in charge when they couldn't get a win together in the first however many weeks of the season. So there's no guarantees that they would have been saved if they hadn't twisted. But I guess Chairman Phil, that is the way to go, isn't it? If you think you're going to possibly lose that lifeline, then you think, well, we've got to change something. And more often than not, it's always the manager that's going to be the one that gets changed. Maybe, you know, as we said, maybe they were sitting there thinking, you know, that's future planning as well. Maybe, right, well, if we go down, do we feel this is the man that can bring us straight back up again? I think with Burnley, it'll be interesting to see, you know, the ownership there. It'd be interesting to see what sort of summer Burnley have and what players they might lose and what they can do to try and recruit to come straight back up. I wouldn't be surprised to see Watford and Norwich straight back up again next season, because that seems to be the way it goes. You know, too good for the Championship, not good enough for the Premier League. But both of them, I think Norwich will be the only one that will probably stick with their manager through the whole of next season, whereas Watford and Burnley, I can probably see them changing their manager midway through next season as well.
Well, Matthew, when you look at Burnley, their gamble is now even more costly, because relegation also comes with their owners starting to call in as much as £65 million in loans. Now, obviously, I think we've kind of surfaced on the leverage buyout. I don't quite fully understand how it works, but my surface understanding is that the owners come in, they use the cash that Burnley had in their reserves to then get more loans, etc., etc., and then get them in this state that they're in. But now it starts to get a little bit more messy, because you've got players on relegation clauses, you've got the vultures circling around Nick Pope. What a mess they're going to be in. Parachute payments are going to pretty much be swallowed up by these loans. Can they bounce back straight away?
I don't think they will. I think I've seen a lot of people sort of say how concerned they are for Burnley, and I am very much one of them. I think with the amount of debt they have and the way it's been, and the way it's been done again, I'm not an expert, but the way I've sort of read into it, as you say, if it's going to go back into repaying the loans rather than sorting out the squad, it's going to be hard, because you imagine there will be some players that are going to be pinched by other Premier League teams. James Tarkowski has been one that's been mentioned. I know Nick Pope, we've had our name mentioned to him. Dwight McNeil is another one who people say, oh, he could be off to a Premier League side. So if there isn't the, you know, upper Championship or lower Premier League quality player there to replace them, then you do wonder where they're going to go. I've heard some concerns that they might be the next Sunderland or Bolton and go, you know, straight back, you know, from the Premier League to the Championship to League One. I don't think it's quite going to be that bad, because I do think even the leftover players, as it were, I think there is enough there for them to at least survive in the Championship one season. then see what happens, you know, the following season with how parachute payments work and all that stuff. But yeah, I don't see it being a total disaster, but I can see why some people might think it would be just because of the state they're in.
Yeah, I mean, that's why the relegation final day was so important. And I think Cole made a good point about Sean Dyche, that a lot of people have been saying, oh, well, if he was still in charge, Burnley would not be in this mess. But I think a lot of people forget that without the new manager bounce that come with Mike Jackson, Burnley would be nowhere near even fighting for safety on the final day. So I think that needs to be remembered. And as you kind of look at the first, 20-odd games and the start they had, Burnley, they kind of are responsible for their own downfall. And the owners could be responsible for an even greater downfall. But we need to stay on the topic of Messi, because now we're going to talk about, not Lionel, but pitch invasions, because they are seemingly back in vogue this week. Cole, obviously, we're seeing signs of jubilation. Now, that's like absolutely fine. But when you see players and managers get involved for, you know, their own safety, getting injured, the Billy Sharp incident, for example, this is where the line starts to get crossed in a rather big way.
Yeah, and as everyone's already said, you know, and all the outlets, it's just completely unacceptable, isn't it? You know, I don't think anyone has an issue with fans running on the pitch to celebrate. You know, it's become a kind of tradition and we know it happens. But as soon as you start going and attacking players or managers, then it's just crossing a line where you do sort of wonder, well, where does it stop? You know, at what point will it happen that someone suddenly brings a knife on or something like that, or does something really serious to a player or a manager as they're trying to get off the pitch, or an official even? So it's just not acceptable. How the clubs go about stopping it, I don't know. But you do have to question the fact that you know when it's going to happen, don't you? You can already preempt, right, last game of the season, if we win this, there's going to be a massive euphoria and people are going to be on the pitch. So it's not like you don't know when that's going to come, so you can't plan for it. You do know when the games where that might happen, and it's going to take a little bit more planning. But supporters have to take responsibility, and you just can't be doing the things they're doing, because ultimately then, if this sort of thing is going to happen, what is the answer? Fences go back up to stop people getting back on the pitch or something like that, you know, for the fact that then we don't want to see a player seriously injured one day. You know, you're always going to have the moronic element, aren't you? You know, the small percent that are morons, you know, most go on to try and do it the right way. You're always going to have that small minority that want to ruin it for everybody. But this is a serious issue that needs looking at, because the scenes that we've seen over the last, you know, few weeks with, you know, the teams where this has happened, you do start to fear that one day someone will seriously get hurt. And then obviously, you know, you then wonder where football goes with fans like that.
Well, this is it, Matthew, because let me try and play a little bit of devil's advocate here. I quite like a pitch invasion, only because when you watch it on TV, it's a good optic. You know, that jubilation kind of carries through. Obviously, we don't want to see the sights that we've seen in the past week, like Billy Sharp getting attacked and Vieira and all that kind of stuff. However, do you think the recent increase in madness, for use of a better word, is due to the pent-up emotion of fans being held back from watching football over the last, say, 2 years because of COVID?
I think there is that element. I have seen it used as something of an excuse, as it were. I know we at Fulham, for instance, have had a couple of instances with fans and their sort of bad behaviour and limbs, shall we say, in quotation marks, for the sake of social media clout, and you know, just effectively, we had a game at Reading where it's, you know, where basically fans just basically not destroyed but messed up Reading Town Centre afterwards a little bit by throwing bins and everything. And when it was reported to the club, it was sort of reported back to say, oh, this is just fans blowing off steam because they've been inside for the past 2 years, haven't really been to football. It's a case of, well, I was stuck inside for, you know, 2 years. I didn't get to go to football for 2 years. As a fan, anyway, I could do it as a reporter. But that's still not an excuse for me to start, you know, tearing things up and, you know, causing unnecessary damage. So I don't want that to be seen as a reason, because, you know, you don't want to tarnish the minority with the, you know, or the majority rather, with the minority that, you know, that cause problems for people. So I don't really see it, but at the same time, I can sort of understand is everyone has, again, when they're inside, they sort of want to say, oh, I want to get back and I want to, you know, make up for it, as it were. But even so, there are still limits. I mean, we've had two pitch invasions this season at Fulham, you know, when we sealed promotion and when we won the title. there wasn't a single incident at either of them. You know, maybe it's because of our opponents. I can't remember who the first one was, but the second one was against Luton, so it wasn't really, it's not really a rivalry per se. There wasn't any agitation or anything going on between the fans and the players to incite something like the Billy Sharp incident, for instance. So it's a bit weird, but at the same time, I don't want to hear that the whole cooped up in time for 2 years is a reason, because I think it's an excuse more than a reason, personally.
Yeah, I think that's a fair shout. And Cole, obviously we can't forget what happened up at Goodison Park in terms of their pitch invasion. The first one happened before the final whistle. Now, I've seen it happen in the past. I remember where I think Stoke got promoted, and it kind of, you see players ushering fans back off the pitch going, get off, we need to finish the game. Even Bristol Rovers the other week, where they got promoted. Like, again, it's happening. But then you see the scenes with Patrick Vieira and that fan afterwards, and you sort of think to yourself, football fans are just doing themselves no favours at the moment, are they?
Yeah, well, that's it, isn't it, Dan? You know, ultimately, and as we say, we know it's a minority. You know, the majority want to go on and just celebrate, you know, try and get to their own players and, you know, lift them up and, you know, get a picture or something with them. But that minority that do these things are going to risk making the rest of them suffer. And like I say, you know, we don't want to see a day where, you know, clubs, I know it probably would never come, but a day where clubs feel that things like fences have to go back up to protect, you know, the players and officials. There's going to have to be some way of coming up with a solution for this. I mean, the Everton one was just mad, wasn't it? That, you know, we knew when COVID came and there were no supporters, one team were going across the other side of the pitch. But again, when you know this could happen, you're going to have to bring in protocols, you know, to say, right, well, actually, you know, when the game's about to end, you know, is it that the referee gives, you know, the opposition players a little warning of like, well, look, listen, when the ball goes out for this goal kick, get yourself closer to the other side, because I'm going to blow as soon as he kicks it and you guys can get yourself off ASAP. But they're going to have to come up with a solution. But those minority are going to end up costing fans, because at some point the leagues will feel they'll need to do something drastic to make sure it stops.
Matthew, will clubs pay the ultimate price in that they could be deducted points, for example? You know, another pitch invasion, you've got stewards on, what, I don't know, £12 an hour. They don't want the hassle. It's very hard for them to fight back the tide of thousands of fans. Let's say a Vieira-like incident happens again, but it's even worse. Should clubs be punished? Should it be just the fans in isolation? If you've got 1,000 fans on the pitch, can you find them all? How do you deal with this?
I think it is something that the clubs need to sort of take upon themselves. I don't think there's going to be any sort of, you know, serious punishment coming off this. You know, there may be a fine or a warning. You know, most clubs would be able to afford it. But I think this will probably be seen as like the last straw, as it were, for football fans and clubs as well. You know, the Billy Sharp incident and the Patrick Vieira incident and the Robin Olsen incident at Man City as well. I think they will sort of over the summer just sort of say, right, this is it. We've had enough. Next, you know, next time it's on you. So I know this is where Simon Jordan saying, you know, should the clubs have to pay to get extra policing in? So it's not stewards. You know, where does that money come from? How does it go down the, you know, down the lower leagues where they can't afford it, so on and so forth? But I think either way, it is going to come. There is a time has come for it to come on the clubs. Now, whether that's right or wrong, I know that, you know, I think in Europe, it's always, you know, the club is always deemed responsible for the fans, even if, you know, it's nothing to do with them, even if it's just some people having one too many drinks in the city centre in Zagreb or whatever, just random place. But if there has to come to something, it has to be on the club, because that way they can police it in a more, you know, stringent and more stricter way. And they can put out the punishment and say, anyone who is caught, you know, lifetime ban, put the onus on the clubs to try and sort it out, rather than, you know, an overarching figure and say, right, all you, you know, X million football fans of a thing, you need to sort out. If you put it on the clubs, they might be the ones to take stricter action.
OK, let's focus on matters back on the pitch now. And Goodison Park's probably the best place to start. Cole, at 2-0 down on Thursday, it was looking like a disaster for Everton. Fast forward to 90 minutes, not the case. They will be breathing a sigh of relief that they were safe before the final day.
Yeah, that was, as you say, Dan, at 2-0 down, you're sitting there thinking, well, they'll need to be going into that last game of the season needing to get a result at the Emirates. And although that would have been, you know, Spurs fans' ultimate, you know, wish, you just feared that if that was the case, Everton, at no point did I think Everton were going to get anything at the Emirates, given their away form this season. So at 2-0, you're thinking this could be Everton done and dusted and gone. But that was some turnaround and a great performance and great character to then suddenly get those two goals back and then find the winner and ultimately give themselves the nicety that they could go into that last day knowing that's it, job done. But that's been a horrendous season for Everton. The implications of what will happen with the financial fair play issues that they've got coming, soon that will hit them, whether that's a fine or what punishments will come for that, we don't know. Is Frank Lampard the man to take them forward? I'm not so sure he's the right manager that's going to improve them that much. Will players leave? Will they be able to get the right players in that improve them? I think it's a worrying time to be an Everton fan, to be honest.
Matthew, in terms of Leeds and Burnley, they've both complained to the Premier League about Everton's largesse in terms of spending. Is this kind of, a fateful roll of the dice that is not going to lead to anything? Or will the Premier League have one last twist in the tail?
I think if it was a Leeds and Burnley thing, I think it might have some legs to it. But I think now that it's just... Because you can't imagine... Unless Leeds want to, die on the moral sword, but given the way they worked under Bielsa, you're not 100% sure whether or not that's in their mantra. But whether or not they stick through and say, right, we started this, we're going to finish it. Or if they're just going to leave Burnley to sort it out themselves. So, Leeds should really just leave it to themselves, leave it to Burnley, rather. I'd be stunned if this does come from anything, especially now. I think it's more than likely this will go over the summer. There'll be appeals, there'll be stuff, and it'll come to a point of, July 15th or whatever, pick an arbitrary date, where there will be a decision come down. They say, right, we can't deduct points and swap leagues over now. So you'll start next season on an X amount of points deduction. I think that's probably more likely. If there is some punishment to come, I think it's more likely that way rather than anything this season. And, they have to get 10 points retrospectively taken off and they go down.
Yeah, I think that ship has sailed in terms of this season. Cole, as for North London, I guess you're breathing a huge sigh of relief as Tottenham got over the fourth place line. All the fears of being Spursy, Antonio Conte said, we'll be having none of that nonsense at Carrow Road.
Yeah, that's right. And, it wouldn't have been Spurs without the fear of there being another Lasagna Gate just before the weekend, was there, with players going down and Gary Lineker tweeting that, all Tottenham have got problems. But I think with Conte in charge, you kind of felt a little bit more confident that this wouldn't happen. And being away at Norwich, given the season Norwich have had, I never really felt Norwich would cause us the upset. You can't be a Spurs fan without that element of doubt in there that something could go wrong. But I honestly did think that, if we could get an early goal, then we could probably go and put Norwich to the sword. Yes, the longer the game went on, 0-0 could have been tense. But then at the same time, a point was all we needed from that game. So I just couldn't not see us getting that over the line against the opposition we were playing. I mean, had we been playing someone like Brighton, or, Wolves or Leicester, somewhere like that, away from home on the last day, I certainly would have been a little bit more nervous. But we got the job done. And ultimately, I think Conte has proven with, the second half of the season and the fact that he's got us there, given he hasn't had a full season, then if we can back the guy and just get him the right tools, hopefully we can, fully cement that Champions League place next season. And who knows, if he gets the right players in, we might be able to get a little bit closer to Liverpool and City and even be pushing Chelsea for a third place.
Well, Matthew, it was an emphatic performance for Tottenham. Heung-min Song has to share the golden boot. Should that detract from his efforts in any way, considering no penalties were scored for his 23 goals? Is that more impressive than the Egyptians' efforts?
I think it is more. I think, in fact, that should probably be a decider. I know, I think in major tournaments, it's like whoever has the most assists or whoever played the least minutes or thing. I think the first thing should be, how many penalties did you take? I think that should be, taken into account. And whoever had the fewest should get the main share of it, if you want. I think it is absolutely astounding the fact that he did it without any penalties. And yeah, even in a Spurs side that were struggling as well during during points of the season, whereas with Liverpool and Mo Salah, they were always going to dominate, they were always going to get chances. Whereas with Spurs, especially with Harry Kane out for the first couple of and his problems in the first couple of weeks, he was never too sure about what some would be able to do without him because of the brilliant partnership they've been able to strike up. But it is incredible credit that he is he's managed to win his share of the Golden Boot. Especially, as you say, the fact that it's without penalties as well.
Yeah, I quite like the fact he's got no penalties attached to his record, because I know a lot of people this time last week were saying, well, if Tottenham are clear and there's a penalty and it might tip Son over the edge to win the boot, yeah, that's very well. But then you kind of tainted it ever so slightly by being given a penalty to win it. I like the fact it's 23 goals, no penalties, perfect. And really, Cole, obviously from a biased point of view, but should there be a definitive winner like Matthew suggests, or are you happy with the award being shared?
I mean, ultimately, it is what it is, isn't it? You know, penalties are considered in that, you know, if you score a penalty, it goes to your goal tally. So it is what it is. But I think, you know, if you look at a moral standpoint, Son should probably feel like he's the winner of that. Because as you say, Dan, if you take penalties out of the equation, there'd be a lot of strikers who might suddenly have six or seven less goals a season. So the numbers that Son has racked up without penalties is just so impressive. And this is not just, you know, this is not a one-off either, though. You know, you've got to look at his last couple of seasons and he's knocking those sort of tallies in. And I agree with you, Dan. You know, I was so happy that there wasn't a penalty because, as you say, the fact that everyone had made this big fuss that, yeah, but he's done it without penalties, and then suddenly to win it by, oh, well, Harry Kane gave him a penalty on the last day, would have kind of tarnished what he's done, I think. So maybe there is an element where, yeah, maybe penalties shouldn't be considered as part of that tally, you know, a bit like a penalty shootout. Those goals don't get put on a player's tally. Maybe, you know, something could change with that so that you then do see, well, who was a true, real outstanding player scoring goals during the season. Because let's face it, you know, if you from 12 yards, most players should be able to knock up a few extra goals on that. And maybe that is unfair to someone like Son, who's had the season he's had.
Well, Tottenham put Norwich to the sword. Arsenal did the same against Everton, but really the horse had bolted by that point. They should have done that against Newcastle. So, Matthew, as someone has no skin in the North London game, has Arsenal's season been a disappointment when you consider that the objective has clearly changed as the campaign has progressed?
I don't know. I think when you say the objective has changed, I think that does sort of change things a bit, because you would have said, you know, getting into the top four would have been the main aim. But then you look at the start of the season and think, oh, maybe the squad isn't quite ready. But then they go on the run they do and put themselves into fourth and think, oh, if they get into the Champions League, with that Champions League money and the prestige of being in it, they might be able to just attract a higher clientele of players to come along with them. So, oh, yes, Champions League might be good. But then again, you look at the end of the season and think, oh, this squad isn't quite ready for the Champions League, even if you did make those additions. So it is a bit of a weird one. I think fifth is still probably where they should rightfully be. And again, looking forward to, you know, looking to next year, I think the Europa League is, you know, has a much better chance of them winning silverware rather than in the Champions League. You look at where they would have gone, you know, pot and seeding wise, they probably would have been drawn in with the likes of Real Madrid and Dortmund, say. And then you think they're not getting past them. They go into the Europa League anyway. So at least in the Europa League, they have those group stages where, you know, young players can come through and everything. And then again, maybe later in the competition, they could go in and, you know, bring the senior players in and look to win it. So I think fit is probably where they should be, and, you know, where they, you know, arguably deserve to be as well. And I think, again, in the grand scheme of things, it's probably better for them, you know, to be in the Europa League and give them another year of development rather than getting them to jump into the Champions League next year. Because I do think there are a couple of players there who I think need that in between rather than just jumping straight into it.
Cole, does Arsenal's situation also highlight how fluid objectives can be? Because if you are starting the season, you wouldn't just say, right, top six, top seven, that's absolutely fine, and then you might be challenging for the title. You might finish second and go, well, it doesn't matter because you only wanted to finish seventh anyway. So when you look at Arsenal's position where they were in March and Tottenham's position in comparison, I don't want to use the word bottom it, but Arsenal have collapsed at just the wrong time, and they will consider this opportunity missed, won't they?
Massively, yeah, because, you know, you hear that all the time, don't you? Oh, if you'd offered me where we are now at the start of the season, but you go, yeah, but that's without games being played and, you know, situations arising. When you consider the position Arsenal were in towards the end of that season and the fact that they had the massive advantage points-wise and just had to see their games out, after that final day, you can't but look and think we've just missed out and bottled a massive opportunity to kind of excel the kind of progress of where the club would be going in the next couple of years. So you've got to look and be disappointed. You know, yes, we know before a ball's been kicked, we'd all say, oh, well, if you offered me fourth, I'll take your hand off for it. But if you've got an opportunity of finishing second with a couple of games to go and then suddenly you don't get second and you end up fourth, I think you have to look back and say, no, that was disappointing because we should have got the job done and this is where we should have been. As you say, objectives change throughout the season. You know, you see where everyone is, what's happening. You know, if your injuries come up, then, you know, you might be expected to finish second. But if you lose four or five players for injuries, the objective has to change because the squad has changed. So, yeah, Arsenal have got to really look and, you know, should feel disappointed because they had it in their hands. And ultimately, you know, it's them same failings that have cost Arsenal over the years have come back to haunt them yet again.
Matthew, do these failings put pressure on Mikel Arteta, new contract or not? Is there going to be more of an eye on him at the start of next season?
Yeah, because I think, as I said, you know, the Europa League is probably an easier challenge for them and something they should be able to do well in. You know, what effect that's going to take on the on their league form, we'll have to wait and see. But I do think there is an element of, right, we've given you this margin that, you know, how much they spent the transfer window last year. You assume they're going to be spending big this summer as well, probably with buying more young players, because that seems to be the path they're going down. And you just have to think, if there are the, you know, immediate results, then you would have to say probably would be under pressure. And I think that, and I think he might be made to leave, just because, you know, there's only so much you can say, oh, we're building for the future before that future has to come. And if it doesn't turn up next season, you know, say they struggle in the Europa League, go down to the Conference League, for instance, or if they, you know, come 9th or 10th, come November time, I don't think it's impossible. Whilst they have, you know, as you say, the new contract, and they've said they've shown the faith, there has to come a point where that faith has to come through. And, you know, you'd have to think, if it isn't this season, when is it going to be?
Right, we've got about 4 minutes left. Let's try and mop up the rest of the Premier League season. We'll do our very best. Carl, Man United limped to 6. Ten Hag in attendance on Sunday. On the evidence of their last 180 minutes, that Dutchman has got an incredible amount of work to do.
Yeah, we've been saying it, haven't we, all along, that, you know, there's a lot of work to do to try and get that side back where they want to be. He's got a massive clear out and a massive rebuild on his hands, and he'll need to get started early. And it's going to take him a good while because, yeah, that club is in a mess.
Matthew, West Ham arguably limped to 7th. Do you reckon they'll be disappointed with their campaign?
I think they would, because, you know, they probably wanted to take a step forward. I mean, in the Premier League, at least, I think they will be disappointed to come 7th. I think, you know, 5th and 6th is probably where they would have looked to have been, you know, if they can't, you know, move forward and move into the Champions League, which, again, they could have done. They would at least look to stay still. Europa Conference League, I think, gives them a great chance of silverware next season. But as you said, perhaps the toll of the Europa League just took a little bit too much on them. But I think they still would be disappointed to not be straight back in the Europa League.
And Carl, Chelsea definitely limped to 3rd. Do you think the takeover gets over the line before next Tuesday? Or is there now cause for panic at Stamford Bridge?
Yeah, well, I think you'd be nervous, wouldn't you? Because you don't know where it goes. You know, there's going to be a lot of players leaving there as well this summer. So there is a bit of a rebuilding job. And, you know, Chelsea, I think, will just be thankful that they got a lot of points on board early in the season. Because if there'd been another week or two to go, then you wouldn't have, you know, you wouldn't have been surprised to see, you know, we were only finished 3 points away from him in the end, and they could have been looking over their shoulders, struggling to qualify for top four, and that would have been catastrophic for them.
And finally, Matthew, Leicester, 8th place finish. Now, in the end, their campaign wasn't as bad, certainly it's not as bad as we made it out to be. Is that going to make life easier for Brendan Rodgers over the summer?
I think so. You know, if they'd have finished in the, you know, bottom half of the table or around 12th or 13th, I think that would have been seems a disappointment. But given how, as you said, they've had various struggles during the season and injuries to have to go over, to get to 8th, whilst it's not European football, which I think, you know, would have made a big help for him, I think 8th is still probably, you know, a very decent sharing and should, as you say, hold him in favour with the owners over the course of the summer.
Right, we've hit full time, not for this week, but for the season. That is what, 8 months, 9 months of podcast action finally coming to a close. An arduous season, but a lovely season. A really great opportunity to chat to you two each week. So I just need to do the admin. Of course, we shouldn't forget Max. He's not here today. A huge effort from him this season. And I look forward to chatting to him when and where I can next time around. Matthew, thanks for your time this afternoon and the season. I hope you enjoyed this one and the season as a whole.
I did, absolutely. I'm looking forward to coming back next season. Hopefully when we'll be talking and be able to talk about Wales getting prepared for the World Cup.
Of course, and a certain Fulham back in the Premier League. Don't forget that. And Cole, as always, thanks for wearing the captain's armband throughout the season. And I look forward to doing it all again after the summer break.
Yeah, no, can't wait, Dan. And hopefully, you know, say we'll have another exciting season to talk about. And, you know, there'll be plenty of action, plenty of controversy. And I can't wait to do it all again.
Absolutely. Right. Cheers, guys. And also to the listeners out there. And with that said, it just leaves me to say that my name's Dan Tracy. This is The Real Football Cast. And until next time, goodbye.
Podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Sports Social Podcast Network.